You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 2003 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the third class in a series given by Brother Ken Somerville on the subject, Prophecies Leading Up to the Return of Christ. This class is titled, Zechariah, Disaster and Deliverance.
Well, we started off with Ezekiel now, and we spent a day with Joel and the two battles. Now we're going to do disaster and deliverance. Because as we know, when we come to the end of Zechariah, the chapter starts off of that 14th chapter with disaster and then ultimately leading to deliverance, which has really been the theme in Ezekiel and the theme in Joel. In fact, it's been the theme of Israel's history, hasn't it been? Disaster, disaster after disaster, with ultimately promised deliverance. In fact, it is the history of humanity, isn't it? From the Garden of Eden, it's been disaster with the hope of deliverance. And of course, that's our lives in summary. The goals for this class, following in that theme of familiarizing ourselves and reminding ourselves, will be to come in at the 8th chapter of Zechariah and work our way to the end, reminding ourselves about the things that have already come to pass, which strengthen our confidence with regard to what is yet to come to pass, and then to look at the end time prophecies that are actually unfolding, some of them right now, and then finally to look at some ingredients for our end time scenario. To familiarize ourselves so that the next time we do our readings, these things will be a little more alive for us, and the next time we open up the front page of the paper and see something, we will perhaps recognize it. Now, Steve's been doing a good job putting Daniel and Ezekiel and Jeremiah in place for us, all as contemporary, whereas Joel was a couple of hundred years before them, when Israel, the northern 10 tribes, were still in the land. Now, Zechariah, he prophesies after Daniel, Ezekiel, and Jeremiah, after the return from captivity, and just before the demise of the prophets, if you will, before we enter into that time we call the time between the Testaments. Zechariah lived in Israel after the return from Babylon, about 2,500 years ago. So we'll come into chapter 8, because from chapter 8 to the end, the primary topic, I'm getting too much in the front of it, aren't I? Okay. The primary topic is, topics deal with the Messiah, prophecies relative to the Messiah and his first coming, and prophecies relative to the time of the end. Zechariah 8, again the word of the Lord of hosts came to me, saying, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, I was jealous for Zion with great jealousy, and I was jealous for her with great fury. Thus saith the Lord, I am returned unto Zion, and I will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem. And Jerusalem shall be called a city of truth, and the mountains of the Lord of hosts, the holy mountain. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, there shall yet old men and old women dwell in the streets of Jerusalem, and every man with his staff in his hand for very age. And the streets of the city shall be full of boys and girls playing in the streets of it. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, if it be marvelous in the eyes of the remnant of this people in these days, should it also be marvelous in mine eyes, saith the Lord of hosts? Thus saith the Lord of hosts, Behold, I will save my people from the east country and from the west country, and I will bring them, and they shall dwell in the midst of Jerusalem, and they shall be my people. I will be their God in truth and in righteousness. So these prophecies going forward here, while not consecutive, and they are repetitive and redundant in places, are full of this measure of hope and deliverance following disasters. You know, Israel has been living in what could be called the penalty phase of a contract. Peter, did you ever get into contracts in your contracting that had penalty phases in them?
Not
in that real sense. You just would lose money on the job. Yeah. After the North Korea earthquake, they wanted to get some of the infrastructure repaired. They wanted to get it repaired now. So they put a deal together down there in 6 months. Anything that could be done in 6 months relative to major freeways and bridges and things like that would be paid for by the federal government. Let me tell you, they let out some interesting contracts. They were very, very motivating contracts. So motivated, one contractor, he hired a train to bring in a steel beam from the East Coast. Because if he got it done by such and such a time, he got a bonus. But he didn't get it done by such and such a time, he'd start owing them money. Big money. It was big, big contract, big money. Well, God and Israel made a contract. And Israel didn't keep it. And they've been living under the penalty phase of the contract. The contract has not expired. It's an awkward thing. In real life, in construction projects, if the contractor folds, that's where the bonding company has to come in and somehow make it work by hiring other companies, and that's where a lot of money gets lost. But in this contract, it's still in force, and Israel has been living under the penalty phase of it. And as we know, to whom much has been given, much is expected, and they were given much. And the lesson that we need to take to that, from that to our own lives is much has been given to us. We have been called. We have been given the opportunity. We have come into Christ through baptism. And this isn't kid stuff. This isn't fun and games. If history and if what's going on in front of us doesn't disabuse us of the notion that these things are optional, that we somehow have the freedom to pick and choose and to do or not do, I don't know what will. Certainly nothing said here. And so this is the situation that has occurred. They've been living under the penalty phase, but the message of hope, talking about the deliverance in the future, in the 20th verse, it says of the 8th chapter, "Thus saith the Lord of hosts, it shall yet come to pass that there shall come peoples and the inhabitants of many cities, and the inhabitants of one city shall go to another, saying, Let us go speedily to pray before the Lord and to seek the Lord of hosts. I will go also. Yea, many peoples and strong nations shall come to see the Lord of hosts in Jerusalem and to pray before the Lord. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, in those days it shall come to pass that 10 men shall take hold of all the languages of the nation, out of all the languages of the nations, even shall take hold of the skirt of him that is a Jew, saying, We will go with you, for we have heard that God is with you." What a turnaround. From having been for thousands of years a despised people, they're going to be held in high esteem. The days of the curse, that penalty phase of the contract spoken of in Deuteronomy 28, will be over. And it's interesting to see in some ways, even the beginning of that. As Israel, while definitely not in any way that is honorable to God yet at this point, nevertheless, while hated and despised by its immediate neighbors, does command a certain amount of respect and have a certain amount of esteem that they did not have until they had their own land, until they had their military victories. Some things are rather humiliating, even for the egos of the Americans. I hear that while the Israelis are flying primarily American jet fighters, they're able to fly them a little better than the hotshot American pilots. That's got to be a little humiliating. Deuteronomy 28:64, "And the Lord shall scatter thee among all the people from the one end of the earth even unto the other, and there thou shalt serve other gods, which neither thou nor thy fathers have known, even wood and stone. And among these nations shalt thou find no ease, neither shall the sole of thy foot have rest." This is the $100,000 a day fine penalty that you as the contractor are going to experience if you don't live up to the contract. But the Lord shall give thee there a trembling heart, and failing of eyes, and sorrow of mind, and thy life shall hang in doubt before thee. Now shall fear day and night, and shall have no assurance of thy life. In the morning thou shalt say, Would God it were evening, and at evening thou shalt say, Would God it were morning. For the fear of thine heart wherewith thou shalt fear, and for the sight of thine eyes that thou shalt see. That's the penalty phase. And that is what has come to pass and what is promised to be delivered from. We're just going to be picking little elements out of these chapters until we get to the 14th chapter. Now, this is one you're familiar with, Zechariah 9. Comes to pass in Matthew 21. And I don't know that you need to turn that up. You're all very familiar with it. We'll use the time in other things. But rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, thy king cometh unto thee. He is just and having salvation, lowly and riding upon an ass, and upon a colt, the foal of an ass. And of course, that came to pass literally when Jesus made that triumphal or that momentarily triumphal entry into Jerusalem. Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. A fulfilled prophecy, which gives us the more sure word. Just a little item out of the 10th chapter of Zechariah, a message regarding the Messiah, in which a number of other prophecies are referred to. Zechariah 10, verse 4. Out of him came forth the corner, out of him the nail, out of him the battle bow, out of him every oppressor together. And it would be referring to Isaiah 28 and 16, where it refers to Jesus Christ as a precious cornerstone. And out of him, which is Judah, shall come the cornerstone. And the value of the cornerstone, for a lot of my business life, I've been in and out of these machine shops, and they spend an awful lot of money for a piece of stone. Be it a little shop, it's a little piece of stone. Be it a big shop, it's a big piece of stone. I don't know what they call them, but their purpose is to provide them a flat surface, a truly flat surface, a precision flat surface that they have to have for their precision measurements. And you can well imagine the importance of an absolutely accurate, precise cornerstone as you start extending walls out and hoping they're going to meet somewhere. And that's, of course, the foundation that Jesus provides us when we look at him for direction. Out of him the nail. And Isaiah, in the 22nd chapter, talks about a nail that was going to be something absolutely fast, absolutely sure, upon which your hopes and things could be hung. In Isaiah's prophecy, it's talking about that nail and using it in a bad way, because it referred to somebody, and that nail was going to be drawn out. But in the case of Jesus, that nail is absolutely secure. Out of him the battle bow. Psalms 45, 1 through 7, it talks about the Messiah shooting God's arrows, and the Messiah as the battle bow. And out of him every oppressor. And actually, the NIV would be a little better there. Out of him every ruler. And that's what's being talked about there. And when we think in terms of Revelation 5 and 10, speaking of us being kings and priests, out of Jesus will come every ruler that will be ruling from then on. So just a little messianic prophecy coming out of Zechariah 10. Zechariah 11. Again, one we're all very familiar with. The 30 pieces of silver spoken of in Matthew. And we'll just have a little aside there, but verses 12 and 13. And I said unto them, if ye think good, give me my price, and if not, forbear. So they weighed for my price 30 pieces of silver. And the Lord said unto me, cast it unto the potter, a lordly price that I was prized at of them. And I took the 30 pieces of silver and cast them to the potter in the house of the Lord. Now, a little interesting aside here, I don't know if you noticed it, but in Matthew 27 and 9, the prophecy is actually ascribed to Jeremiah. The 9th verse, Matthew 27, it says, then was fulfilled that which was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet, saying, and they took the 30 pieces of silver. The best explanation that I have of that is that the Old Testament was, of course, in scroll format in those days. And they had three major scrolls. The first scroll was called the Law, and that was from Genesis to Psalms. The second was called the Psalms, which was from the Psalms to the Prophets. And the third one was the Prophets. And the ancient prophetic scrolls began with the prophet Jeremiah. So it was not uncommon for everything that followed to be referred to as coming out of the book of Jeremiah. So I found that a little interesting explanation of something that otherwise I didn't know what they were getting at there. Now, Zechariah 12 took an interesting turn in my mind as the events of 9:1:1 occurred. Zechariah 12, the burden of the word of the Lord of Israel, saith the Lord who stretched forth the heavens and layeth the foundation of the earth and formeth the spirit of man within him. Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling unto all the peoples round about, when they shall be in the siege, both against Judah and against Jerusalem. And in that day will I make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all peoples, and all that burden themselves with it shall be cut in pieces, though all the nations of the earth be gathered together against it. And here is an end-time prophecy that we would probably all concur has been already unfolding. To Israel, Jerusalem is very much a cup of trembling to its neighbors, and that we clearly see in the wars that have been fought there from 1947 on. And I always looked at the third verse referencing Jerusalem as a burdensome stone in the same light. Now I'm wondering if there's possibly another light in which it can be seen, and that is that almost anybody that has anything to do with Jerusalem, even if they try to help them, gets hurt. I can't go too far with that because clearly the scriptures say that he will bless those that bless Israel and curse those that curse Israel. And everything the United States has tried to do or would seem like has been to help Israel. But nevertheless, it does seem that it's hard not to get hurt in certain situations. No doubt, in Samaritan situations, in reality, the same consideration would come forth. The idea of stopping and helping somebody beside the road in a dark night does carry a certain amount of attendant risk to it. It might not be legitimate, and we weigh those things, don't we? The 10th verse of Zechariah, taking a different tone, talking about after Jesus has manifested himself to the people, and I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplication, and they shall look upon me whom they have pierced, and they shall mourn for him as one mourneth for his only son, and shall be in bitterness for him as one that is in bitterness for his firstborn. These are verses, a lot of them we're very familiar with, and what we're going to be trying to do, of course, Friday is set them in some chronological order. Because I think most of us would agree, looking for any repentance on the part of Israel before Jesus' return is much more optimistic than the scriptures would allow for. By the way, you might notice in Zechariah 12, the number of times the phrase "in that day" appears. And when you're doing your readings, it kind of becomes like almost a mantra you're beginning to repeat as you read through it. In the third verse, "in that day." In the fourth verse, "in that day." The sixth, the eighth, the ninth, the 11th, and in the first verse of the 13th chapter, "and in that day." It would be nice if that day referred to a day, but of course it doesn't refer to a 24-hour day. It refers to a period of time when these events are going to occur. It would be nice if "in that day" always referred to one particular battle, and you could key it in that way, and that would help guide you, but it doesn't. But it certainly refers to a day of the Lord as a day of judgment. I think someone touched on earlier in the week that Psalm, "This is the day that the Lord hath made. I will be glad and rejoice in it." I don't want to be repetitive here. I forget exactly now what was said. But that verse is quoted out of context by us quite often as a wonderful thing. But it really isn't. It's talking about the day of judgment. And of course, as one of the other prophets have said, we have to be very careful about looking forward to that day. Because he says, you know, "What are you looking forward to it for?" he says to the Jews. "It's not going to be very good for you if you haven't been living properly. It won't be a good outcome." The 13th chapter, and this is interesting because we're going to tie a few things together here. And these are some things that some of the pieces of the puzzle we'll be picking up. Zechariah 13, "In that day there shall be a fountain open to the house of David and to the inhabitants of Jerusalem for sin and uncleanness." Now we'll just pick up on some of these references. Zechariah 14 and 8. What we're going to be picking up on is a matter of the fountains and the water, and you're familiar with all these. 14 and 8 says that, "In that day, living waters shall go out from Jerusalem, half of them toward the former sea and half of them toward the hinder sea. In summer and winter shall it be." So what are we looking for there is a miraculous change in the geography, the topography, a fountain breaking forth. And we've considered that. Ezekiel 47, 1 through 2. Now, as we said on Monday, Ezekiel, the last from chapter 40 on, is dealing with the millennial temple. Ezekiel 47. "Afterward he brought me again unto the door of the house, and behold, waters issued out from under the threshold of the house eastward, for the forefront of the house stood toward the east, and the waters came down from under, from the right side of the house at the south side of the altar. Then brought he me out of the way of the gate northward, and led me about the way outside, and into the outer gate by the way that looked eastward. And behold, there ran out waters on the right side." And then he describes it. "When a man had the line in his hand, he went from the eastward, and he measured 1,000 cubits, and he brought me through the waters, the waters were to the ankles. Again he measured 1,000 and brought me through the waters were to the knees. And again he measured 1,000 and brought me through the waters were to the loins." And then in the fifth verse, "The waters were so deep that a man had to swim over them in order to pass over. And again he said unto me, Son of man, hast thou seen this? And he brought me and caused me to return to the brink of the river. Now when I returned, behold, at the brink of the river there were many trees on the one side and on the other. And he said unto me, These waters issue out toward the east country, and they go down into the Arabah, and they go into the sea, and being brought forth into the sea, the waters shall be healed." So that sounds like the healing of the waters in the Dead Sea. "And it came to pass that everything that liveth, which moveth wherewith the waters shall come, shall live. And there shall be a very great multitude of fish, because these waters shall come there, for they shall be healed. And everything shall live where the water cometh." It talks about the fishing industry being able to be resumed in the 10th verse. Of course, the salt will continue in the marshes. This is talking about quite a geographic change in the kingdom. Revelation 22 picks up on this or repeats this idea, might be a, or sets forth a similar idea. Revelation 22. And he showed me a pure river of water of life, clear as crystal, proceeding out of the throne of God and of the Lamb. And in the midst of the street of it, and on either side of the river, was there the tree of life, which bore 12 kinds of fruits, and yielded her fruit every month. And the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. And there shall be no more curse, but the throne of God and of the Lamb shall be in it, and his servants shall serve him. In fact, we might continue with some other changes in the fifth verse. There shall be no night there. They shall need no lamp, neither the light of the sun. For the Lord God giveth them light, and they shall reign forever and ever. Beginning to get a mental picture here, aren't we, of the kingdom and the idea of a huge source of fresh water miraculously springing out of a fountain on the mountain of the Lord, running to the Mediterranean as well as to the Dead Sea, somehow circling the temple area, being so deep that it can't be passed over other than swimming. When we put that together later on this morning with the idea of the nations coming up each year to worship, will they have to be baptized, as it were, certainly cleansed? Will it be physical? Will it be spiritual? We know that Paul refers to, I think it was Paul, yes, the Israelites being baptized under a cloud, as it were, in the wilderness. And will these leaves on the trees be given for the healing for the nations? And so they come up each year, and will they in fact be getting something like the tree of life, as it were? Will there be something in that that sustains life in the millennial age to where a child shall die 100 years old? And of course, in John 4 and 10, Jesus clearly says that he is the living water. As he tells the woman by the well in Samaria that although he had asked her for a drink, if she'd asked him, he would have given her water to drink of, whereby she would never thirst again. This symbolism, this combination of literal, our literal physical baptism, which without the spiritual impact is nothing more than a bath, but with the spiritual import properly understood, in fact, grants us entrance into the covenant relationship with God. This interweaving of it throughout the Bible in so many different ways and in the prophecies all plays a role. Zechariah 14. This is where we want to be. And we're actually going to come in at the very end of Zechariah 13. I've always loved that line, that the original manuscripts had no punctuation. And so the Bible was originally punctuated for the first time by an itinerant preacher on horseback, which does not give you a whole lot of confidence where all the breaks might occur. Zechariah 13 and 8. And it shall come to pass that in all the land, saith the Lord. Now we think we're talking about the first battle. That two parts in it shall be cut off and die, but the third shall be left in it. We're not talking about anything that has ever occurred in the past, because he said, and I will bring the third part through the fire, and will refine them as silver is refined, and will test them as gold is tested. They shall call on my name, and I will hear them. I will say, it is my people, and they shall say, the Lord is my God. Now, we know that hasn't happened. So what we're looking for is a terrible, terrible battle. Many years ago in Los Angeles, I had a Jewish customer, Orthodox Jewish, real character, Benny Ross. And he was going to, this was in the 60s, late 60s, forget what was going on. Are going to be killed? He says, all right, Kennedy, I'm going to Tel Aviv. That's Jerusalem he's talking about. Yeah, it was. I had coffee. I could tell you some funny stories about Benny. It was a very interesting relationship. I'll bring the third through the fire and will refine them, and they will say, "The Lord is my God." Behold, the day of the Lord cometh, and thy spoil shall be divided in the midst of thee. For I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken. Hard to imagine the city of Jerusalem being taken if Jesus is there. And so, this then fits in that category of being the first battle that we're looking for. The houses rifled and the women ravished, and half of the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue shall not be cut off from the city. Now that's quite a picture. We've got an invading army, and evidently we've got a holdout group in a section of Jerusalem that has having to be bypassed, as is very common in military things, for the moment. And so one section of the city is bypassed, and then the Lord goes forth and fights against those nations as when he fought in the day of battle. And his feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem in the east. And the Mount of Olives shall cleave in the midst of it, so toward the east and toward the west, and there shall be a very great valley. And half of the mountain shall remove toward the north, and half of it toward the south. And ye shall flee to the valley of the mountains. And so we get some kind of a picture here where it's almost as if a way of escape is provided miraculously by this earthquake that provides an, all of a sudden, an opportunity for some of the survivors to flee. You shall flee as ye fled from before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. And the Lord my God shall come, and all the saints with thee. So at that point, Jesus has returned. There's been already the resurrection and the judgment. And Lord willing, we are part of this army of God providing the deliverance of Israel. But it shall be one day, and it shall come to pass in that day that the light shall not be clear nor dark, but it shall be one day. Now, we know that in the Old Testament it records an incident where the sun stood still. And that's unimaginable, isn't it? We can't fathom that actually happening. But I submit that there would be nothing like it for convincing the world that God was involved. I mean, it gives you a definition of the word incredible, doesn't it? Even we who maintain that we believe in God and His power and that He created things and controls the universe can't really get our mind around the idea, because we cannot find any rational way keep everything from falling apart in the universe for that to happen. Now, of course, there are the possibility of it being explained in other ways, but it could be that way. It shall be one day, which shall be known to the Lord, not day nor night, but it shall come to pass that at evening time it shall be light. And it shall be in that day that living waters shall go out from Jerusalem, half of them toward the former sea. This becomes a rather minor miracle by comparison, doesn't it? Just a little opening up of a spring in a strange location, a Mount St. Helena blowing up and providing an earthquake way of escape. These are relatively minor things. We can get our minds around them. Half of them toward the former sea and half of them toward the hinder sea. In summer and in winter shall it be. Interesting comment. For those of you who live in Portland area, that doesn't really have any particular meaning. For those of us who live in Los Angeles, that does. We don't have any rivers that run in the summer. We're lucky if we have anything that runs in the winter. But in Jerusalem, they didn't have summer rivers. You know, they just had them when the rain fell. And the Lord shall be king. The Jordan does attempt to flow, but. And the Lord shall be king over all the earth. In that day shall there be one Lord, and his name one. And all the land shall be turned like the Arabah from Geba to Rimmon south of Jerusalem, and it shall be lifted up and inhabited in its place from Benjamin's gate into the place of the first gate unto the corner gate and from the tower of Hananel unto the king's wine presses. And men shall dwell in it, and there shall be no more utter destruction, but Jerusalem shall be safely inhabited. And this shall be the plague with which the Lord will smite all the peoples that have fought against Jerusalem. Their flesh shall consume away while they stand upon their feet, and their eyes shall consume away in their holes, and their tongue shall consume away in their mouth. And it shall come to pass in that day that a great tumult from the Lord shall be among them, and they shall lay hold every one on the hand of his neighbor, and his hand shall rise up against the hand of his neighbor. And Judah also shall fight at Jerusalem. And the wealth of all the nations round about shall be gathered together, gold and silver and apparel in great abundance. And so shall there be the plague of the horse, of the mule, of the camel, of the ass, of the beast, that shall be in these tents as this plague. It may be that that 14th verse is talking about the second battle. Because at the second battle, Judah will be God's goodly horse in battle. Judah also shall fight at Jerusalem, and it seems to be a victorious fight versus any fighting that Judah does in the beginning of the 14th chapter, which is clearly just paving the way for disaster. 16th verse, after the victory, those are my words, of course, and it shall come to pass that every one that is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem shall even go up. That almost implies that all the nations won't be involved in the second battle. We talked about how in the first battle, clearly there are named nations, and we can infer other unnamed nations, that would be fighting against Israel. And we said there were clearly some nations that seem to be called out as not going to be fighting. Sheba, Dedan, those that are described by Tarshish. And here, just taking the text as it's given, it shall come to pass that everyone that is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem isn't quite saying and of all the nations in the world. It sounds like some, and so we would hope and pray that some nations won't, in that final conflict, go up against the Messiah, that won't be part of that group described in the second Psalm, of having a plot against the Messiah. We would hope that this country would not. It remains to be seen. It shall come to pass that everyone that is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem shall even go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. And it shall be that whoever will not come up of all the families of the earth unto Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, even upon them shall be no rain. And we all love this one. And if the family of Egypt go not up and come not, that have no rain, well, they'll be taken care of as well. There shall be the plague with which the Lord will smite the nations that come not up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. You know, we wonder how logistically will that occur? Can't imagine all the nations going up. We see how the Muslims do it, right? Everybody is supposed to make a pilgrimage to Mecca in the course of their life. More if they can, a pilgrimage. Will it be done through representation? God has historically dealt with people through representation and as individuals. He's dealt with us through the kings, through the prophets, through the Messiah, through leaders, as well as dealing with us each individually. We have this dual responsibility. We're responsible for the spiritual health of others by our actions, by our teachings. But we also know that each of us are going to give an account for ourselves. How will it be? A brother came and gave a series of classes at Idlewild on the temple. He gave them in a nice way, on the temple in the kingdom. He was not in any way dogmatic or controversial, and it was just designed to help you think about the kingdom age, and it accomplished that very nicely. And you started thinking about the logistics of feeding great hordes of people as they came up, forgetting about all the people in the world, I mean, of course, it's a theoretical possibility that all the people might not be that many either, but putting that gruesome specter to one side, as I sat there, all of a sudden, I thought, big deal. God's feeding 6 billion of us now. Not all of us well. Some of us are starving. But it's amazing. He's feeding roughly 6 billion people. We have, there's no organization. We don't have a planned economy in the world like the Russians tried to do that didn't work. It just happens somehow. Like the sparrow getting fed. 19th verse. This shall be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all nations that come not up to keep the Feast of the Tabernacles. In that day shall there be upon the bells of the horses holiness unto the Lord. And the pots in the Lord's house shall be like the bowls before the altars. I don't know if you remember, but years ago, all of us were diligent about getting our bumper stickers on our new cars, you know? It's kind of a fad that's passed. I guess maybe some people are a little embarrassed about it. But in the kingdom, nobody will be. You won't mind having a horse that has a little sign on it that says, Holiness unto the Lord. Won't bother you at all. You won't be ashamed to put that bumper sticker on at the time, will you? Yea, every pot in Jerusalem and in Judah shall be holiness unto the Lord of hosts. And all they that sacrifice shall come and take of them and boil in them, and in that day there shall be no more a Canaanite or a traitor in the house of the Lord of hosts. Well, that takes us through a chapter that has some principal and pieces of the puzzle, as we know. We're well into the process of that day. Israel is a burdensome stone back in the land. Animosity and hatred are growing hourly, bringing the nations around Israel to the point where they could attack in a rage. You imagine, we were talking the other day here, are any of you aware of the societies that exist, the organizations in Jerusalem that want to rebuild the temple? You've read a little bit about them? There's, I don't know how many, 6, 8, 9 of them. There's a book about some of them. It's kind of interesting. Some of them want to rebuild it one way, some another way, some at any cost. Some have to be watched by the Israeli authorities like a hawk, because they'll blow up the Dome on the Rock. Can you imagine what would happen if a Jewish zealot group blows up the mosque on the Dome of the Rock? Can you imagine what could happen? So while we're sitting here wondering what's going to happen next and how long it's going to take, it could happen. Another major terrorist attack against America will trigger latent, could trigger. I shouldn't say with, I should say could trigger latent anti-Semitic feelings and legitimate concerns in the U.S. to protect its interests by distancing itself from Israel. Have you heard those comments at all? I mean, they're reasonable comments. What's this got to do with us? Why should we be any more involved over there than we are in Bosnia or Herzegovina or Cambodia? These people want to kill each other. They've always wanted to kill each other. You know what? We've tried. We've tried our best. And it's our sons and daughters that are getting killed. It's our economy that's going down a tank. You know what? Let them have at it. And this may very well be the sentiment that leads to the fulfillment of Isaiah 63 and 5. It's just a little one-liner which we will be pulling back up Friday. But he says, I looked, and there was none to help. It's going to come the day, based on that prophecy in Isaiah, when there will be no United States backing. There'll come the day when we might have the explanation for why they stand back in Ezekiel 38 and say, hast thou come to take a spoil to this invading host? They will have had it. They will have had all the casualties. A couple of, you know, another 9-1-1 or two. Wouldn't take much more than that. The impact, the effect of 9-1-1 on this country, psychologically, economically, has been incredible. They could They were successful beyond their fondest, anything they could possibly have imagined. At an incredibly economical cost. We are in the same position the Jews were when Jesus came the first time. We live at a culmination, in fact, the culmination point of God's plan for the earth. You remember how that amongst the population of Israel, there was this awareness level that something was going to happen. A Messiah was going to be born. Herod was aware of it. The scribes and the Pharisees, some people were hanging around the temple expecting it to happen, right? You've observed, we're so fortunate in this country, I don't think you'd be able to say this if you lived in England, but in this country, there is a general awareness. We Christadelphians don't have a lock on this understanding of a lot of these prophecies. We're not alone in figuring a lot of this out. There are millions and millions of devout Christians in this country who are expecting the Lord's return just as, not exactly as, we don't even have one mind on the subject completely, but, you know, not exactly as we are. Maybe they're looking for a rapture, maybe we're looking to be taken away to a judgment seat, and they're looking to go in the sky, and we don't know how we'll get there, but it's amazing the similarity in the times when Jesus came the first time and now. We're human, we're not fearless, but we're not confused and hopeless. Terror to others is a sign of Christ's return to us.